The song was a hit, a mega hit, back in 1991. Can it possibly be that long ago for Nirvana? The title, Smells Like Teen Spirit, is sort of our segue into the next part of the program. Smells, odors, the lingering sense of the paranormal and the supernatural. You know, witnesses all over the world have claimed to have seen ghosts and spirits and aliens, UFOs, Bigfoot, different kinds of monsters and other phenomena that are not supposed to exist. So we trust our eyes. Sometimes we trust our ears. But should we trust our noses? That's the question asked by this new book, The Brimstone Deceit. Our own Greg Bishop, who's our webmaster tonight, who's also an author of a couple of books that are classics in their own right, says this is an instant classic because it articulates a refreshingly original approach to the paranormal, and more importantly, how witnesses interpret their experiences. Joshua Cutchin is the writer, and he joins me in just a moment. Joshua Cutchin is a native of North Carolina with a long interest in Fortiana. He holds a master's in music literature and a master's in journalism from the University of Georgia. Currently works as a public affairs specialist in the Southeast. He was my guest last year to talk about a book he wrote called A Trojan Feast, The Food and Drink Offerings of Aliens, Fairies, and Sasquatch. His new work is called The Brimstone Deceit, an in-depth examination of supernatural scents, otherworldly odors, and monstrous miasmas. Joshua, great to have you back.
It's absolute pleasure. What a wonderful way for me to kick off Halloween, seeing as it's already Halloween here.
Yeah, that's a great topic. And gosh, you found, as you did with the A Trojan Feast, you found this really cool niche that has not been really examined before. At what moment did you realize, gosh, there isn't a book written about this?
Well, you know, it was something of an outgrowth of the last book, A Trojan Feast, because in a lot of those stories, you would run into accounts where people would not only get food and drink from these entities, but also report some sort of smell associated with it. So it was one of those moments where I sat back and I said, you know, there might be a book in this, because it's one of those things that has been addressed even at chapter lengths in other literature before. But no one has ever taken a step back and said, perhaps there's something of importance in the types of smells that people have encountered in a lot of these Fortean or Magonian events. So between that and the fact that I'd often heard this connection, this long-standing connection, that a lot of paranormal activity of all shapes and sizes manifests themselves with an odor of brimstone, it seemed like a good subject for me to sort of pick up.
You're not necessarily endorsing you believe in aliens or fairies or any of that stuff. You're just reporting the phenomena as recorded over the centuries, and there are some patterns that emerge.
Oh, absolutely. I try to maintain a healthy agnosticism about these subjects in general, and what I tend to do is mostly just literature surveys, just taking a look at what has been reported, not really doing too many judgment calls on what is and isn't quote-unquote true, and seeing perhaps there are some implications that are a natural outgrowth of that. You know, it's also tempting for some people to see a title like The Brimstone Deceit and automatically jump to the assumption that I think everything is demonic, and that's not the case either, because not only do we talk about smells of sulfur, but there are other common outliers that you find in a lot of these paranormal events.
Well, it's a great title. I think it sounds like a Robert Ludlum novel.
It does a bit, doesn't it?
So let's start with, you know, I'll tell you what, even without the paranormal and supernatural angles, I was really interested in the whole idea of smell as an unfairly treated sense. So why don't you sort of explore that theme, because it is an important thread throughout the book.
Oh, well, it's absolutely fascinating to me when I started digging into this to see how little we really understand about smell. I mean, smell is interesting because it's, you know, in classical philosophy, it was considered neither external nor internal. It was sort of on the liminal boundaries in terms of, you know, being perceived in your body but coming from outside the body. But what's even more interesting than that to me is the fact that we still don't really have a great idea of how smells work. For example, the most commonly accepted notion is that there's a sort of lock-key configuration where certain cells in the nose correspond to specific molecules. And if a molecule, thinking of that as a key, and a lock, thinking of that as the cell, are compatible, it sends a stimulation to your olfactory bulb. But what's interesting to me is that some people have even proposed quantum ideas for the level at which smell works. So it's one of those things that, not unlike dreams and not unlike some other things about our natural world, is very commonplace, but we don't quite have a really firm grasp on how it works.
Well, yeah, you mentioned about how it's sort of dissed throughout history. Smell has sort of been dissed. I mean, seeing is believing, but really, as the point you make is, smelling is trusting, because the nose knows. I mean, I know it's true for me. I mean, that's probably my most developed sense is smell.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's one of those things that, from a philosophical standpoint, especially in the early church, it was viewed as sort of a base sense, and the way that it could sort of an influencing or corrupting sense to sort of sway your opinion of something from the objective, visual sight to something else, because we all do trust our noses, even if we don't realize it. I mean, that bit of turkey in the refrigerator might look great, but if it smells bad, you're going to throw it away.
You make the point that, it seems like sight is the one that counts, that even in classical development of science, that some of the early philosophers and scientists would regard sight as a premier sense and smell was lesser so.
Yes, absolutely. To the extent that some philosophers were actually instructed in their schools of thought to literally disregard scent, and a lot of early scientists were thought to disregard scent. Now, of course, all this sort of went out the window when the concept of miasma theory came up, which is the idea that supposedly foul smells were actually the source of diseases and the plague. For example, in the 1300s. Scholars said that the Black Plague was because of a deadly corruption of the air. And even this isn't just necessarily an old world belief. I mean, in the New World, around 700 BC, there was a Native American legend that a horned serpent rose from Lake Ontario and spread a disease by emitting its foul breath over the land. So there's this connection that not only can smells influence perception, but they can have a physical effect as well.
You make the point, too, of how the sense of smell and the importance of the sense of smell changed as humans evolved, just because we're further from the ground.
Exactly. I mean, so Freud had the idea that perhaps this was part of mankind's natural evolution, sort of evolving away from smell as being a more sexual sense, because we're farther up from the ground, we're farther up from some of those more stimulating so it's almost like smell sort of coincides with the upright posture that man assumed over time as being sort of pushed to the background. But it still remains sort of this animalistic sense that keeps us grounded and rooted in our everyday life. And really often, quite often, in an invaluable sense. I mean, there are many times when people have been alerted to things as dangerous as gas leaks or fires or whatnot simply by smell alone.
Yeah, you're developing something that you can't see. I mean, you're sensing it. It's almost sort of like a supernatural ability in a sense.
Exactly. I make the argument that you would be hard pressed to find a better metaphor for smell, because not only is it invisible, but it also is very tangible for those who experience it. And it's one of those situations where this is something invisible and intangible that, those who smell it know is there, and it also can influence us. I don't think we all realize quite how strongly smell can influence us, not only in terms of swaying our opinions, but also in terms of just actually getting to us at a psychological level.
And saving our lives in a lot of cases.
Yeah, precisely, precisely. And it's really interesting, there's been some correlations between an inhibited sense of smell and encroaching Alzheimer's disease in patients. So there's this connection between smell and memory that I think is often overlooked as a possibility of something that might be ripe for deception. Anyone who has ever had a cologne or a perfume from an ex-lover and smells that perfume years later knows that whether they want to think about it or not, they end up immediately thinking of that person. So if there was a supernatural intelligence of some description that can control and manipulate us, smell would be an excellent choice for a sense of manipulation.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, it the link to memory is really strong. I think about some smell of bread or something like that. It takes you back to that place immediately, or a time in your life, or it's like time travel.
It really is.
So let's start talking about smells and the paranormal. I know that you write early in the book about how the church sort of degraded the importance of smell, and they may have had ulterior motives, or the early development of the church. Maybe they didn't want us to indulge in earthly delights as much as the sense of smell might allow.
Yeah, it was also, you know, with this idea of it being a more animalistic-based sense, you often get this comparison that it's something to be to not be trusted. You see this sort of in the latter half of the Bible, where Judas objects when Mary anoints the feet of Christ with fragrances. Similarly, you'll see a lot of early Christian thought warning against the influence of smells. And interestingly enough, in some exorcism cases, you see that smell was sort of the inciting incident. For example, there was the Loudon possession of 1630. Supposedly, a bouquet of musk roses was the avenue of access that Satan had to infest the sisters' souls. Of course, this event was probably exaggerated by the church, but this was supposedly the sneaky way by which Satan was able to enter the bodies of these innocent nuns.
I don't want to test your memory too much because I know it's probably been a while since you wrote this, but you have a story about something called the Drummer of Tedworth, or modern-day Tidworth.
Yes, yes, yes. So there was mid to late 1600s case. It was actually a poltergeist case. And there was a drummer who had come through this village in Wiltshire, and who was drumming day and night incessantly, and was irritating a local landowner by the name of John Montpesson. And Montpesson won a judgment against the drummer because he actually ended up exposing the man as a con man. And even though the drummer fled town before being able to face his sentence, there was this disembodied drummer that would hang around the estate. And it would beat on for days and nights, and there would be strange growls and strange dark forms with glowing eyes. But another very pervasive aspect of it was this sulfurous smell, which was described as very offensive by an objective third-party witness. And it was revealed later that allegedly the drummer of Tidworth, as it was dabbling in witchcraft and had actually put sort of a hex upon the Montpesson family.
The idea that of smell as something bad, that we can somehow innately sense it, it goes way, way back. You mentioned about how the early, I think, in human origin myths of some tribes, the nature of how people know instinctively that something that's dead smells bad, or if it smells bad, it's dead, and that's bad for humans as well. That's sort of a theme all the way through.
Yeah, it is. I mean, so well, number one, spoiler alert, there are a lot of smells of sulfur in this book. Number two, even when people don't smell sulfur, they often smell what you would categorize as the smells of entropy. So smells of decay, smells of rot, smells, even unpleasant smells that are unpleasantly stimulating, like certain chemical smells or smells that will be described as acrid. And a lot of times, you know, this reinforces this gut reaction. I believe the term is the hedonic value. The hedonic value is the value that you assign to something because of the manner in which it smells. So in other words, if you are conditioned to associate a smell with a certain emotion or a certain a value judgment of something, then you will perceive it as good or bad. So while on the surface this is pretty evident for someone who smells something like rot, it gets a little bit more confusing when you get into things like bacon or garbage. Like, I think bacon smells great and garbage smells bad, but I'm neither a vegan nor a garbage man. So, you know, it's sort of this learned assumption between smells and what we should expect from that smell signifying that I find really fascinating.
Well, some of it is sort of universally bad, I guess, the sulfur smell. And let's just jump into the deep end here, because you spent a lot of time on the sulfur smell. That kind of cuts across a lot of boundaries in terms of paranormal supernatural stuff, because it pops up in so many different ones. And you mentioned and quote the work of John Keel a couple of points in the book.
Absolutely. It's one of those things that I suspect that it's not a majority of supernatural cases that involve the smell of sulfur, but I do suspect strongly that it is a plurality. In other words, we're coming up on election season, so here's a good example. If Hillary gets 60% of the vote, she has a majority. But if Hillary gets, let's say, 40% of the vote, and Trump gets 30% of the vote, and Jill Stein gets 30% of the vote, well, Hillary is still won, but she won with a plurality, not a majority. So I suspect that perhaps a plurality of supernatural encounters involve this sulfur smell, but there's a lot of fascinating things to unpack about sulfur. First of all, pure sulfur actually does not smell at all unless it's burnt. And when it's burnt, it usually releases some sort of compound. So when people in paranormal encounters say that they smell sulfur, they're most likely not really referring to sulfur. They're referring to one of several sulfur compounds. What I found were most common were sulfur dioxide, which is the smell that we would associate with fireworks or gunpowder, also the smell of burning sulfur, or hydrogen sulfide, which we all know as a sort of rotten egg smell. What I find really amazing about sulfur compounds in general is that they are among the most sensitive to the human nose of any compounds on the planet. So if these entities, whatever they might be, don't wish to be noticed, they're definitely choosing the wrong smell. For example, hydrogen sulfide, I find this statistic absolutely fascinating. Hydrogen sulfide, the rotten egg smell, our sensitivity to it is 0.5 parts per billion. Now, to put that into sort of a natural comparison, if you took an ink dropper and put one drop of ink in the back of a tanker, a fluid-carrying tanker truck, right, that is twice the concentration at which we can detect hydrogen sulfide. So we're extremely sensitive to some of these compounds.
And the sulfur, I guess, you know, just it's been drilled into us that that smell is bad. Sulfur by itself has no smell. It's the compounds, as you note, that get our olfactory attention. It seems that it's forever been linked with demons and demonology and some kind of satanic presence. But as you note in the book, in the beginning, it wasn't that way.
Yeah, this is something that I found absolutely fascinating, is this idea that sulfur historically, and all the way to stretching back into antiquity, has actually a pretty pleasant reputation. For example, it was used for a long time as an antimicrobial in ancient Greece. In ancient Egypt. In ancient Greece, its connection was so strong with divinity that the term for sulfur and the term for the divine were very similar. They shared the same root. So brimstone was Sion, and divine was Thios. And this was this idea that this admittedly incorrect idea that lightning strikes coming from above, from the gods above, released sulfur. Now that's sort of another conversation for us to have on down the road. But returning to this idea of sulfur as being something divine, you find similar comments in the Bible. I mean, for example, you will find comparisons of God's breath as being cleansing, and being compared to the smell of sulfur. When Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed, they were destroyed with, you know, fire and brimstone by the Lord, not by Satan. And then lastly, what was fascinating to me was the fact that when Satan was thrown in the Hebrew Bible into the lake of fire and brimstone, that wasn't an attempt to, you know, please Satan. It was an attempt to cleanse Satan by means of these cleansing agents, by means of fire and brimstone. So when we think about the devil smelling like fire and brimstone, or like brimstone, or like sulfur, we shouldn't conceive that as the smell of something evil necessarily, as much as, you know, historically or in terms of Christian mythology, it's the smell of the Lord's attempt to purify evil with this commonly held fumigant, sulfur.
As you note in the book, of course, a rose by any other name smells just as sweet. Linda Ronstadt, Love is a Rose, takes us into the break. We'll be back with my guest Joshua Cutchin and the Brimstone Deceit after this. Lynyrd Skynyrd from 1977, you knew I'd have to play this song, That Smell, the lyric by Ronnie Van Zant. He had written that the smell of death surrounds you 3 days after this album was released. Most of the band, including Ronnie Van Zant, killed in a plane crash. So he had sort of a feeling that things were headed in the wrong direction. We're talking about smells, odors, scents. The Brimstone Deceit is the name of the book. Joshua Cutchin is the author. And in this next segment, I want to ask for some specific examples of the kinds of smells that have come up in association with ghosts, spirits, demons, monsters, Sasquatch, and aliens. So stick around, much more to come. So Joshua, tell us some stories. Let's start with sulfur, which, as you note, I mean, it sort of cuts across all categories of paranormal. It pops up all over the place. Are there some stories you could tell us about where it is actually associated with reports of demonological type encounters?
Absolutely. So there's a long-standing tradition, especially in the Christian church, that the demons being part of Satan's basically army smell of sulfur as well. But what's interesting is that even certain demons could be summoned by procuring sulfur. For example, in certain grimoires, it was asked that to sort of make the demon feel at home, you would actually end up lighting some sulfur in your ceremonies. Similarly, those who were in the service of the devil were supposedly said to smell foul. One description of witches said that they smelled like old cabbage and gunpowder, which are both variations on sulfur smells. The interesting thing is that we don't really realize how many unpleasant smells include this sulfurous compound. I mean, not only does sulfur and hydrogen sulfide and the smell of rotten eggs have this sulfur undertone, but also decaying flesh, cabbage, and even skunk spray all have that as well. It's interesting. Sometimes people who were supposedly being taken in at black masses and baptized into the devil's service would be given baptism in water, sulfur, and salt. But in terms of like more modern encounters, you do have people who quite often encounter smells of sulfur. For example, there is a gift shop in Mount Holly, New Jersey, that supposedly is often besieged by the sound of marching boots and a strong smell of sulfur that they attribute to a Hessian soldier who raped a young girl during the American Revolution. Similarly, you'll find tales of people like, for example, famous ghost investigator from England, Andrew Malcolm Green, moved into a house as a child and noticed an odd sulfur odor in a mezzanine. And they found out later, after they looking into the history of the house, that the house was actually the site of 20 suicides and one murder. So it's interesting that even when not explicitly demonic, the sulfurous smell often does seem to be attached to entities with some sort of malevolent agenda.
UFO, alien stuff, there are sulfur cases, right?
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting because sulfur and ozone have long been conflated. I mentioned earlier how lightning was said to bring sulfur from the sky. Well, actually, that's the smell of ozone. And because of that, it became something of a minor meme in ufology that ozone was the most common smell. But if you look at the way that people describe smells, and obviously people don't say, oh, it smelled like sulfur dioxide or it smelled like hydrogen sulfide. But if you look at the way that people describe smells from UFOs, oftentimes they're described as having some sort of gunpowder odor or a rotten egg odor. It's one of those things that you don't really realize until you really look through the literature how often this crops up. Similarly, I mentioned how skunk smell actually derives a lot of its odors from this underlying compound, which is ethyl, which if you remember, I talked about with brimstone being Saon and the divine being Thios. Well, thyl is a sulfur compound, and skunk spray is full of thyls. And interestingly enough, some people have described a sort of skunk spray odor in conjunction with UFOs. There was a case from the late 60s in Massachusetts that had a similar smell. You'll also find people who say that some UFO encounters smell like, home cooking gas. Well, home cooking gas is actually odorless. Thyls are added as a sort of alarm system for us whenever we have a gas leak so that we can detect a gas leak. So if somebody says that a UFO smells like natural gas, well, it smells like sulfur again. So it's one of those things where the explicit number of times that people say that aren't as prevalent as the number of times that it's heavily insinuated.
Again, Bigfoot.
You don't see ozone, but oh, Bigfoot as well. So I mentioned the skunk spray aspect. That sometimes crops up as well, so you have to consider that. But there are plenty of cases of Bigfoot smelling like rotten eggs as well. For example, there was a person who in October of 1965 was crossing the Alaska Highway in British Columbia, and noticed that there was this large hairy figure that left behind a lingering smell of egg. Similarly, you'll see people describe Bigfoot as smelling like a septic tank. The reason that a septic tank smell like hydrogen sulfide is because hydrogen sulfide naturally occurs wherever there is bacterial decomposition in the absence of oxygen. So obviously this happens within an eggshell, but it also happens in swamps and bogs and obviously septic tanks where you have decomposition underneath the water. So a lot of the times these smells are implied, but you often find, at the same time, you do find explicit encounters. There was another person near Muscle Shoals, Alabama in 2005, relatively recently. Two witnesses who were on a deer hunt with Sasquatch, and they actually were spooked by the smell of rotten eggs and something dead and earthy associated with the creature as well.
You've even got one version of Sasquatch or Bigfoot, the skunk ape, that's sort of named for its smell.
Absolutely. And in most of the cases, there was a very prominent skunk ape flap in the 1970s in Florida. And the skunk ape is a long tradition going all the way back into Seminole folklore. The term skunk ape doesn't really appear to have appeared until during that 1970s flap. But at the time, a majority of the sightings were associated with this sort of manure smell or this musky manure, rotten egg sort of odor as well. And people have talked about, like, what does this mean? Does it mean that it's inhabiting, places that give it this smell, or is it something that the creature actually exudes on its own in the form of a soot gland or something?
That maybe it wants, that was an interesting part of the book, is that you raised the question of whether or not it wants you to know it's there. It wants people to smell it as a way to stay away or be aware that it's in the area. And you mentioned a study of gorillas that sort of relates.
Exactly. So there's a loose correlation between Sasquatch that are noticed and release a smell versus Sasquatch who don't notice the witness and don't smell. So because of this, a lot of people have suggested that perhaps Sasquatch has some sort of scent gland that it actually wants to release as a way of deterring individuals. It's interesting. This has been a subject that has gone back and forth a lot, and hopefully I dug deep enough into it that I provide at least some semblance of closure to the notion. If Bigfoot is a mammal, by default it has scent glands, because all mammals have types of scent glands. I mean, even human beings have sebaceous scent glands ourselves. The question is whether or not they have a scent gland that they can deliberately control, like a skunk or other mustelids, so skunks, weevils, badgers, etc. And interestingly enough, not only have gorillas been proven to have a scent gland, a lot of times people have said that when gorillas are fleeing poachers or something, they'll smell like this, having had a sort of burning rubber smell. But it's also been proven in relatively recent research, I believe in the past decade, that gorillas can actually exert control over this scent gland and actually use it as a form of communication within their troop. Interestingly enough, that burning rubber smell also has a sulfurous connotation. I know we wouldn't think of this normally, but sulfur is used in the vulcanization process to strengthen rubber. So again, you see this tenuous little connection between these smells and sulfur. I mean, there's no shortage of Bigfoot tales where people have also compared Bigfoot smell to burning rubber as well.
Let's talk about ghost smells, because I guess sulfur does pop up here and there, but there's a whole range of smells associated with ghosts or spirits. And as you note in the book, I mean, in some parts of the world, the belief is that they don't have any smell at all.
Right, exactly. So, in African folklore, I think is what you're referring to,
yes.
There's this belief that goats don't have a smell, but their fingernails do, which again is interesting because I hate to keep on saying this word. If anyone's playing along at home, maybe it's a good drinking game to take a shot every time I say sulfur. The reason that fingernails smell when burnt, rather, is because they have keratin compounds, which again derive their strength, not unlike vulcanized rubber, from sulfur. But depending on the part of the world that you're from, there are specific smells that are associated with ghosts. Supposedly, in Aboriginal folklore of Australia, they said that ghosts smelled stale and that ghosts couldn't abide the smell of pregnant women. Similarly, the yokai of Japan, that rich, rich ghost tradition from there, attributed a variety of smells to different entities, but most of the title is a sort of rotten or putrid odor. In the West, we encounter all sorts of smells. Practically anything can really be a ghost smell in American and Western society. Two of the most common smells that people report are smells of perfume, so most commonly lilac or lavender, and smoke, and usually assigned respectively to women and men, which I find actually sort of fascinating. I went into a little bit of a digression in this in the book. Historically, men have used cologne just as much as women have used perfume, and historically, women have smoked just as much as men, especially at least until recently. So there is this interesting idea that I have that perhaps we are misattributing some of these smells sometimes. I mean, I wonder how much of the witnesses are playing a role in sort of creating a narrative around these particular smells, because it seems just as likely that a woman might smell of cigar smoke or something if you look at these historical hauntings.
Yeah, you look at some hotels or something that market themselves as a haunted hotel, please come stay here in room 45 or something like that. I think maybe there's some creative marketing opportunities there that maybe they perpetuate the myth in some cases for commercial reasons. And then, as you note in the book, there are other reasons why certain smells pop up in old buildings. There's some physical reasons for it.
Absolutely. So it's one of those things where, so returning sort of back to this idea of a smell of being used sort of exploited for monetary gain, it would be very simple, very easy to sort of apply an atomizer in a hotel or a restaurant and sort of spritz a little bit of smell every now and then. But it has been shown that in certain old homes, the smell of, for example, a fire or a hearth can actually be retained in the fireplace. So, one example from an investigator who found that the smell of a woman's perfume had actually seeped into the woodwork around the fireplace, and that every time the fire was started up, it would sort of open up the pores in the wood, and the smell would seep back out. So, you do find these sort of exceptions, very prosaic exceptions. To a lot of these encounters. For example, there was another example that I found of a story where this family felt that they were being besieged by demons because there was this sort of a rotten smell or a sulfurous smell, and it was determined that whenever it would rain, fissures in the ground would open up underneath the house and release basically subterranean gases, like hydrogen sulfide and sulfur dioxide, which are two very common subterranean volcanic gases.
Well, there are some cases, spirits, ghosts, whatever you want to call them, where some smells pop up that are not as easily explained. Some incidents at Gettysburg, for example.
Yeah, so it's interesting because if I'm in a hotel, especially a well-traveled hotel, there are plenty of places that I might be getting a smell from. So somebody might have, wasn't supposed to be smoking and they ended up chucking a cigarette butt in the corner and that's the smell that I'm getting. But when you look at places like Gettysburg, which have been exposed to the elements for a century and a half, there is no real reason that you should be smelling the scent of gunpowder. Even with the frequent reenactments that they have there, there's no reason that gunpowder should linger in that environment for any amount of time. Yet people still do encounter these odors. One of my favorite tales was the story of some individuals who were filming Gettysburg, which was actually filmed in the park. And there were some extras who were sitting around sort of chatting, and this gentleman dressed in a uniform, I can't recall if it was for the Union or the Confederacy, but he steps out of the brush and he hands the extras some musket balls and says, "It was a rough one out there today, boys," and he was accompanied by the smell of gunpowder. And the extras actually ended up taking those musket balls to an artifact dealer in Gettysburg who confirmed that they were genuine. That's probably the most charming story that I ever ran across in terms of the battlefield, because a lot of the energy and a lot of the stuff that you read about surrounding Gettysburg, not only in the town but also the battlefield as well, tends to be of a much more oppressive, sort of negative variety.
You have other stories of sort of what would almost be like a time warp kind of experience, a time slip, where people are in the modern era and then they not only smell something unusual, but see things for a brief period.
Yes, I mean that's a very common thing as well. Which, for example, there was one interesting case of an individual who had purchased a home from his some ancient relatives of his, and I believe this was in England. And every year, around a certain time of year, they would notice this really strong wood burning smell. And they didn't really attribute it to paranormal activity until there was a young lady caught out of the corner of his wife's eye. And after digging around and looking into the history of the property, they discovered that there used to be outbuildings on the property where some French prisoners had been brought following the Napoleonic Wars. And tragically, all of them died in a statewide house fire. That was around the same date, I believe on the exact same date, that they would often smell this burning wood sensation. So the question is, you know, how much of the past is bleeding into the present, and how much, you know, or is the present bleeding into the past, or how do you interpret that?
You have another example that's closer to home for me. It's the MGM fire, a huge fire that was when I was first here in Las Vegas. I forget how many people, it's more than 80 people, I think, who died in the fire. The MGM was leveled, and then they built Bally's on top of it. But there are occasionally stories that employees tell about things that they encounter. Please share some.
Yes, absolutely. It's one of those. It's a very modern disaster, and I think it was high 80s in terms of the number of people who were killed. But a good friend of mine, Steve Stockton, claimed that he, whenever he would be working in the casino following the rebuilding, that he would encounter this awful sort of artificial burnt smell that would sort of hit him a lot of times at his office. And he used to keep a fan going. He said that even when he had his fan going, it would show up from the opposite direction in terms of the direction that the smell would come to him from, which definitely implies that it wasn't being carried on a wind of any sort.
And at the MGM, have you heard any stories where they see or hear things as well to go along with that, or is that kind of an isolated tale?
No, I don't know if you've ever had the chance to talk to Steve, but he has tales upon tales of this sort of thing, and I've heard other sort of rumblings on the internet and whatnot about people who have encountered, for example, sensed presences in the bathroom, or people being tugged on in the bathroom, or you know, the sounds of people clearing their throats when no one's around. I believe it was in the same casino. It might have been a different one. Steve had some experiences with a dark room that would not stay shut. He used to take photos for people coming through the casino. And there was this dark room door that wouldn't stay shut. He was talking to someone who had worked there in the past and who ended up looking at the door and said, you know, I never liked working in here because that door would never stay shut. So it wasn't something that just he was experiencing.
And of course, as you note in the book, you know, sometimes we interpret the goodness or badness of an entity based on how they smell. Oh, yeah, it's a bad smell. It must be demonic. It's a good smell. It must be a good spirit of some kind. We're going to get into examples of that, plus delve into the world of UFO and alien smells as we continue our conversation about the brimstone deceit with my guest, Joshua Cutchin. And we're going to go into the break with Jay Giles, and you can guess what that song's going to be. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM.